From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the national uprising led by Black Lives Matter called for a defunding of police this year, a demand that has gone hand in hand with it, but received less attention in recent months, is the end of mass incarceration in the U.S. America locks up more people than any other nation in the world. And in late 2018, a broad coalition from the left and right came together to endorse a bill called the First Step Act that many hailed as progress toward ending mass incarceration. But that bill, which was signed into law by President Trump, did little to actually end the problem and instead shifted funding from traditional prisons toward programs that ended up sounding an awful lot like incarceration by another name. My guest is Maya Shenwar, editor-in-chief of Truth Out and author with Victoria Law of the new book Prison by Any Other Name: The Harmful Consequences of Popular Reforms. The book has a foreword by Michelle Alexander. Maya's earlier book was Locked Down, Locked Out. She also co-edited the anthology Who Do You Serve, Who Do You Protect? Welcome to the program, Maya.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
So it seems as though people on the left and right agree that we lock up too many people in this country. Just coming to that place has been, you know, has taken decades, right? Has been something that activists like yourself, journalists, writers, advocates of those imprisoned have spent decades demanding that lawmakers address. But now it seems as though even those on the right who have been the biggest advocates for mass incarceration do concede that we lock up too many people.
Yeah, you know, it's been an interesting development seeing this coalition form of people, I wouldn't say necessarily on the left and right, but kind of
the center left and center right,
some conservatives, yeah, who are coming together around this and have for the past several years around an agenda of prison reform. And one thing we've seen among conservatives, people like Grover Norquist and Newt Gingrich and others, Jared Kushner, who've advocated around prison reform, is it looks very, very different than what some of us on the left have advocated. They've done a lot of advocacy around cost savings, privatization, promoting privatization as a solution, and talking about shrinking the prison system as if it's almost solely about saving money. And of course, not at all about redirecting that money toward life-affirming priorities like education, like healthcare, like the arts, like housing, which has been rather central to the message of the movement to defund the police recently and the long-running movement to abolish policing in prisons.
So tell me about the First Step Act and what it actually did. It was, you know, hailed to great fanfare in 2018, and some even conceded, oh, maybe Trump really, you know, the broken clock is right twice a day, and on this issue he was right in signing this bill.
Right. So the First Step Act was applauded almost all across the political spectrum, though not as much on the left in terms of people who'd been working on these issues for a long time. And it kind of advocated this very small reduction in the federal prison population, which isn't even the majority of people in jails and prisons. It's a small percentage. And it allowed some people who were classified as low risk an early release from prison, sending them often into home confinement and electronic monitoring. And electronic monitoring actually sees an expansion under the First Step Act. We also should look at the fact that the First Step Act was not retroactive, which was a demand of police unions, actually, that it not be retroactive. So the fact that politicians were actually conceding to police unions on this legislation should be a sign to us that it's not actually progressive. But one of the things that Victoria and I look at in depth in our book is this expansion of electronic monitoring and how even in moving small numbers of people out of prisons, we're seeing even larger numbers of people being shackled at home on electronic
explain what electronic monitoring devices are.
So we refer to them in our book as ankle shackles. They're now a common component of the criminal legal system. About 200,000 people, it's estimated, are now on monitors. And it's basically a GPS device strapped to your ankle, which monitors your every move and ensures that you don't leave a certain radius. It'll beep or signal the authorities in some way if you step outside of this radius. And you need to get pre-approved permission to leave for anything. So let's say you have a doctor's appointment. Let's say you've managed to get a job, which is much harder to do on electronic monitoring. Any of these things, you need to get pre-approved permission. And so people run into all kinds of problems while on these devices, including under COVID. One thing we're seeing is people are having trouble seeking emergency medical care. And certainly, and we talked to a number of people on electronic monitoring, and also the first I saw of this was many years ago. My sister was on electronic monitoring on house arrest herself. And one thing that was just readily apparent is you're not able to do any of the things that you would ordinarily do on the outside to build a meaningful life. So if you have children, you can't take them for a walk, take them to the park. Certainly in normal times, you would not be able to pick them up from school or attend sports games or any of those things. And a lot of times they say, oh, well, you know, if you get a job, you can leave the house to get a job. But very often people on monitoring have a hard time getting hired. So you're not even leaving for that. And meanwhile, the penalty for violating these very, very harsh, strict terms of monitoring is often reincarceration. So electronic monitoring becomes a driver of incarceration because violating the terms can get you sent back to jail, sent back to prison very quickly.
How do electronic monitoring programs disproportionately impact people of color? I imagine that just as mass incarceration disproportionately impacts people of color, Black and brown communities, Black communities in particular, that the same is true for these so-called reforms?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's actually one of the things that is a misconception around some of these alternatives and reforms is that they address or eliminate racism from the system, which is totally impossible because the system is built on white supremacy. And so this is still a form of a cage. It's still built on a foundation of white supremacy. So just an example, in Cook County where I live, 70% of people on electronic monitors are Black, although Black people are 24% of the population. So this system is not actually addressing who's targeted, who's arrested. And of course, Black people, brown people, sex workers, drug users, disabled people are all targeted in these vastly disproportionate numbers for arrest, for incarceration. Electronic monitoring doesn't change any of that. It simply offers another alternative cage that someone can be sent to once they're sentenced or once they're charged, if they're there on pretrial detention. And so we're not seeing this so-called alternative address any of the systemic forces that are driving the system.
Maya, you mentioned earlier that the idea of reducing mass incarceration by the right especially has been seen primarily in numbers in terms of driving down costs. I wonder if it's also a matter of transferring dollars from public spending to private spending, from public institutions to private institutions. You said that, you know, the move to private prisons is part of that. But also, for example, I understand that these, the government doesn't manufacture electronic monitoring devices. These are probably lucrative contracts for private companies, right? So if you expand this program, you're putting tax dollars into the hands of private companies who are probably making a big profit based on this sort of surveillance.
That's absolutely true. And some of the same companies that are private prison companies are also electronic monitoring companies. So Geo Group, for example, a lot of these big private prison companies, you see them now, especially in this age of reform, also doing the work of electronic monitoring. And one thing that I want to point out about this is that it's not simply about privatization. It's also about shifting the costs onto the person who's been convicted, who's been targeted.
I see. So they have to pay for their own monitoring?
Exactly. Wow. Right. So people are paying for their own punishment, their own confinement. So we see people paying anywhere from $3 to $40 a day to have this thing shackled around their ankle.
$40 a day?
Yeah, there are people who are paying $40 a day. And we see this happening, of course, to people who are in vastly disproportionate numbers, low income. And also to actually find a job, to make money. And often, in addition to electronic monitoring costs, they're paying other fines and fees imposed by the court system. And you also see people who are reincarcerated as a result of not being able to pay the fees that come along with electronic monitoring. Wow. So it's another form of debtor's prison.
Let's talk about drug treatment programs. These sound nice. There have been far too many people imprisoned for minor drug-related offenses. And often you hear prison reformers say we need to have drug treatment programs rather than prisons. So do we have such programs, or have such programs been expanded? And are they any better than prison?
Yes. So drug courts have expanded quite a bit over the past few years. And you're right, they're seen as this automatic alternative to incarceration, since so many people who are incarcerated do have some sort of diagnosed substance use disorder. In fact, some studies have found the majority of people who are incarcerated, especially among women, have substance abuse disorders. But the thing about drug court is it's not actually doing anything to reduce or end criminalization. Drug court is simply another court that people are routed through that tends to prescribe treatment centers instead of incarceration. Now, sometimes these are inpatient treatment centers, which we describe in our book as lockdown drug treatment facilities, which sometimes operate very similarly to prison. So in some cases, you're not allowed to leave. You have to abide by very, very strict regulations. You are, living with a roommate, eating at very specific times, subjected to very punitive measures if you don't follow the rules. So they mirror prisons in a lot of ways. But even if you're in an outpatient treatment program within drug court, you're still seeing a lot of the same mechanisms at work. And one of those mechanisms is their abstinence-based programs. So you see very, very frequent drug testing. And the idea is that if you test positive for drugs, you're opening yourself back up to being reincarcerated or perhaps punished in some other way by the criminal legal system. And one of the things we see with drug courts that happens with a lot of the reforms that we mention in our book is they widen the net. So providing
some more people in those sort of reformed, so-called reformed prisons than even prison.
Right. So So when you give police this option, and there's a good Drug Policy Alliance report on this, a lot of studies have shown that when you give police this option for drug court and you say, okay, this thing exists, then they tend to actually target more people and disproportionately communities of color for small-time drug offenses. And so actually the number of people being targeted expands. And in some cases, that actually increases the number of people who are potentially sent to prison because it's so hard to abide by the terms of drug courts, similar to electronic monitoring, similar to probation. You're putting people on these very, very strict conditions, and you're not actually offering them much support in terms of shelter, food, jobs, mental, like actual mental health treatment, things that would actually support someone in living an independent, self-determined, meaningful life. Those things are commonly not offered at all. And instead, you've got these punitive restrictions placed upon you. And as with so many of these alternatives, the penalty for not following them is incarceration. So you're just seeing people in a loop, violating the terms of drug court, going back to incarceration.
And so meanwhile, politicians pat themselves on the back saying that they've overseen these so-called reforms, and then the bigger problem of mass incarceration is not just ignored, it's actually exacerbated. What could real reform look like? What if prison abolitionists actually asked for over the years whose real suggestions have really been ignored?
So I think we're in a very exciting moment for this because we see abolitionists and especially young Black abolitionists at the fore calling for the defunding of the police. And what defunding the police means is not simply subtracting funds from police budgets. It's, first of all, eventually eliminating police budgets, but also a dramatic reprioritization toward life-affirming priorities like education, healthcare, housing, the things that actually foster collective safety and build a society where the kinds of violence that people are scared of, the reasons that people say we need police in prisons, become almost unthinkable. So fostering a safe society is about thinking through these kinds of supports, thinking through the types of things that actually pave the way for everyone to have a good life. And so I think that's part of it. I think another part of it is when we talk about prison abolition, we're not just talking about eliminating police, eliminating prisons and increasing support. We're also thinking about figuring out new ways to deal with harm or expanding old ways to deal with harm outside of police and prisons. And there's been so much exciting work in the realms of restorative and transformative justice that now I think is getting a lot more attention during this new climate. And so we see that. And then I think also one of the things that we challenge in our book is the idea that you can reform a system on the same foundations that it was built on and expect to have an entirely new thing. So a lot of the reforms that we address say that they're getting rid of racial bias, but they're still built on the same system of criminalization that grew out of slavery, that grew out of indigenous genocide, that grew out of all kinds of laws that targeted marginalized people, including sex workers, including workers who were participating in uprisings and rebellions. And so part of the work that people are doing right now and have been doing for decades in prison abolition is actually the work of dismantling white supremacy and dismantling criminalization, challenging the idea that we should even label someone as a criminal, that we should create a class of people that we foist this label upon and then say, okay, we need to put these people somewhere else. So challenging that in its entirety, as opposed to a logic of replacement, which a lot of these reforms assume, which says, okay, instead of putting people in prison, we'll put them someplace else. We'll put them in this nicer looking prison that's called a drug treatment center. Okay, instead of police, we'll bring in something else. We'll bring in private security guards. So abolition is talking about dismantling that system and simultaneously creating something new, creating something life-affirming and abundant and something that actually serves the needs of humanity.
How does the work of prison abolition go hand in hand with the Black Lives Matter led movement to defund the police? You mentioned earlier that the Fraternal Order of Police is, you know, the nation's largest police union, helped to push the so-called reforms in a worse direction. Police are, of course, the main problem when it comes to criminalization of communities of color and the beginning of the prison pipeline, right? So this, I imagine, has to be a central part of the conversation. But in recent months, during this national uprising, we haven't seen much of that conversation.
So I think that what's exciting about the call to defund the police and this resurgence of Black Lives Matter organizing and the continuation of many decades of organizing for abolition and Black liberation is it's not a reformist reform. It's the kind of call that actually is on the path to abolition. So when we saw in Minneapolis at the beginnings of this current phase of uprisings, in response to the death of George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd, we saw groups like Reclaim the Block, Black Visions Collective, that were not just saying, okay, we need some laws around chokeholds, we need some laws that will create community review boards or create community policing. No, they were saying defund the police in the service of abolition. They were
right. I mean, organizations have been saying that, but unfortunately, the people who control the national discourse, such as the op-ed writers of the national of the corporate media outlets, who were actually finally taking seriously the call to defund the police, weren't making the links with ending mass incarceration or ending prisons altogether.
Right. Well, I think there's this real fear of accepting the true meaning of defund the police. Mm-hmm. And we see these strange interpretations in the dominant media, which are saying, don't worry, defund the police does not mean abolish the police. It means slightly reduce police budgets. It means create more funding for community policing, which of course is regular old policing by another name. And that's a fundamental mistranslation. And I think that we need to be wary of these attempts to reinterpret the language of defunding that are happening all around us, because they're attempts to water down what is a liberatory mission. And also a radical one, an excitingly radical one. And I think another thing, when you talk about how the conversation around the police is sometimes divorced from prisons in some of the mainstream dialogues, I think that's another symptom of this underlying fear and this desire to maintain the system we have, maintain this system that grew out of white supremacy, that is the violent capitalist status quo, basically. Because if you take away police somehow without taking away prisons, I don't even know how that would work, then you just have other people doing the work of policing. So what, you have social workers putting people in prison, you have private security guards putting people in prison. You know, so I think what we have to do in combating that kind of messaging is challenge the system of criminalization as a whole, the system of actually rendering a person a criminal. Like, I think that we need to be careful of replacement in any of its forms. So in our book, we talk about replacing prisons with electronic monitoring or with psychiatric institutions or sex worker rescue programs. But also right now, there are these conversations about replacing police with social workers, replacing police with guards, replacing police with medical professionals. And so a few weeks ago, Victoria Law and I did an event with Miriam Kaba, which was called Abolish Policing, Not Just the Police. And it was challenging this idea that we should be calling upon, basically enlisting other types of professionals to come in and do the work of policing. And we already see this within the so-called child welfare system. We see social workers and teachers and all kinds of other people who've been deemed mandatory reporters to Child Protective Services, we see them asked to do the work of policing in relation to parents, to do that surveillance and report people, and often start a cycle that results in punishing people in one of the worst ways possible, taking away their children. And of course, these systems are overwhelmingly targeting Black and Indigenous mothers. And so I mentioned that system as an example of the fact that already it's not just official police officers doing the work of policing. And so we have to approach this with a very broad lens.
Maya, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with your book.
Oh, thank you so much, Sonali, and thank you for having me on.
My guest has been Maya Shanwar, editor-in-chief of Truth Out. We've been discussing our new book written with co-author Victoria Law called Prison by Any Other Name, The Harmful Consequences of Popular Reforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.